I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Since Donald Trump returned to office, his administration has quickly moved once again to whitewash U.S. history. In March, he signed an executive order called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. This kind of historical erasure has long served as a warning sign of authoritarian leadership, which seeks to rewrite the past to control the future. On today's Your Call, we're kicking off a series on U.S. history with two Indigenous scholars. The Trump administration is moving to erase Indigenous history while celebrating settler colonialism and Native genocide. A few weeks ago, he said he would no longer recognize Indigenous Peoples Day and would instead, quote, bring Columbus Day back from the ashes. He also brought a portrait of Andrew Jackson, the 7th president, back to the Oval Office. According to Native News Online, among Native people, Jackson is commonly referred to as the removal president and the Indian killer because he signed the Indian Removal Act that stole millions of acres of land from tribes that led to the forced removal from tribal ancestral lands to the west of the Mississippi. The harsh removal campaign is commonly referred to as the Trail of Tears, which resulted in thousands of deaths of Native Americans. The Trump administration also temporarily deleted federal websites featuring information about the Navajo Code Talkers during World War II and cut $1.5 million in grants to Indian boarding school research projects. Trump is brazen, but this is about so much more than Trump. Is it possible for a country built on stolen Indian land to move forward without coming to terms with its past? Today, we are joined by Professor Chanina Lomewaima, who is Muskogee and Creek Nation. She's a retired professor of Indigenous Studies who served on the faculty at the University of Washington, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State University. Professor Lomewaima's scholarship on the federal off-reservation boarding school system is rooted in the experiences of her father, Curtis Thorpe Carr, a survivor of the Chilaco Indian Agricultural School in Oklahoma, where he was enrolled from 1927 to 1935. Professor Lomewaima has written several books, including They Called It Prairie Light, The Story of the Chilaco Indian School, and To Remain an Indian, Lessons in Democracy from a Century of Native American Education. Hi, Professor Lomewaima. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Rosalind LaPierre is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana and Métis. She's an award-winning Indigenous writer, environmental historian, ethnobotanist, and professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Professor LaPierre works within Indigenous communities to revitalize traditional ecological knowledge and to strengthen public policy for Indigenous languages. Professor LaPierre is the author of two books, Invisible Reality, Storytellers, Storytakers, and the Supernatural World of the Blackfeet, and City Indian, Native American Activism in Chicago, 1893 to 1934. She's also written two Blackfeet language lexicons and dozens of articles and commentaries, which have appeared in many publications, including The Conversation. In October, she wrote a piece for The Conversation about her personal experience with boarding schools. She writes, "I'm a direct descendant of family members that were forced as children to attend either a U.S. government-operated or church-run Indian boarding school. They include my mother, all four of my grandparents, and the majority of my great-grandparents. At 84, my mother is the only living Indian boarding school survivor in our family. She shared her story with the Department of the Interior this past summer, as did dozens of other survivors." Hi, Professor LaPierre. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me today.
Well, I'm so glad to have both of you. You know, I have to say, when I was putting this show together, just reading about everything that Trump has done, and he's done it so quickly, I'm sure none of this is surprising to the two of you, but when I got to thinking about it, I was thinking this is about so much more than Trump. I mean, he's brazen, you know, saying we're going to bring Columbus Day back from the ashes. He called him Christopher in his Truth Social post, putting a portrait of Andrew Jackson proudly in the Oval Office. He's brazen, but this is about so much more than Trump. I mean, Professor LeMay Wyma, I've listened to a lot of the interviews you've done, and you say ultimately the reason why this country does not come to terms with its past is because it's about land, and it's always been about the land.
Well, I think that's the continuing thread through the history of the U.S. and its relationships with Native people. I mean, that's a fundamental reality. Every square inch of the nation is built on the lands of other nations, of Native nations. And a lot of that real estate was, title was not transferred cleanly, even by Euro-American standards. So I think there's a fundamental tension there that's just at the root of everything, including the very long-standing resistance on the part of the U.S. to really understanding, let alone recognizing or respecting, the inherent sovereignty of Native nations. And that's led to a lot of federal policies and practices, including the practices of removing children from parents and families that both Rosalind's family and my family experienced, which I think most people in the U.S. today would consider a fundamental breach of a fundamental human right to take your children away. But Native people have always been in a special category, I think, and I think we're seeing that a resurgence of that notion in these recent policy announcements and executive orders.
Professor LaPierre, what would you add? You wrote a piece in the Missoula Current in 2020 called "We're All on Indigenous Land," and you write, "At the time, I teach in the Environmental Studies program at UM, and my family's been in what is now Montana for thousands of years. I am Blackfeet on my mother's side and Métis on my father's side. I often introduce myself jokingly by saying I am a 100th generation Montanan. Indigenous people have been in North America for more than 30,000 years. Each year, new scholarship pushes that date further back." So what are your thoughts about this, that so much of this is about land?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree with Chenina and what she just said. I think that part of this, what we're seeing right now is really erasure, right? We're seeing erasure happen at the executive level here in the United States. And part of, this erasure of Indigenous people, off the land and landscape, then, that leads to us, meaning the universal us, believing that no one was here, right? And if nobody was here, then this is kind of land free for the taking. And that's a way to kind of rewrite the history of what is now the United States and erase Indigenous people off the land. I think that's kind of the ultimate narrative that is being spun here. And it's something that is problematic, as you already pointed out, on many levels.
And how are you thinking about this moment? Because Trump is so brazen and does things that most modern day presidents would not do, it's so easy to say that this is all about Trump, but it's not. Because putting the show together, I thought about all of the conversations I heard about democracy. So many historians were asked to come on public radio, the cable shows, and talk about how democracy was at risk during another Trump term. And they talked about the history of the country. I do not remember any of them talking about Native history. It's just so erased on so many levels. So Professor LeMay Wyma, how are you thinking about this? Because it's so easy to just point your finger at Trump, but it's about so much more than him. He's just so open about it.
Well, I agree with you that in many respects, what we're hearing from President Trump in a way is like the tip of an iceberg. I mean, he's tapped into something that's resonating with a lot of folks in the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's how he got elected. So, he's come to try to implement, I think, some feelings that have been there forever, basically. and we've seen this at different points in the history of the U.S. I kind of concentrate on the turn of the last century, the early 1900s, and there's some interesting resemblances between then and now. Certainly, citizenship was a huge topic at that time, a very highly contested topic, huge debates over immigration and who might have rights to claim to naturalized or birthright citizenship. And that's the period of time when Congress passed a law in 1924 declaring birthright citizenship, U.S. citizenship for American Indians. So there's nothing exactly new in this moment. I think it's just a resurgence of a feeling of pretty severe discomfort, I guess one would have to say. I don't know how else to describe it. On the part of settlers and folks of settler descent with how this nation was founded. They apparently don't have the capacity to face up to that, which is, you know, or they choose not to. I should say they choose not to face up to that. People talk a lot about erasure. They also talk about ignorance as if those are the same things, and they're not. I think erasure points us toward a willful ignorance of Native peoples and Native history and of U.S. history in many ways.
What would you add, Professor LaPierre?
Well, I think you're right. There has been this kind of conversation going on recently, right? Kind of out there in media, among all the pundits and other professors, where they are not mentioning this long history that we have here in Native North America, and not recognizing, you know, the sovereign nations that were here before the United States became a country here. So I agree that that sort of has been missing from this conversation that is happening. And I think that it is helpful if we do include Native nations as part of that conversation, because I think that it will allow us to have a better understanding of this place and a better understanding of the history of the United States. I think one of the things we often do in the field of history is we silo things out, right? So we have sort of U.S. history, Civil War history, you know, the history of the enslaved, Native American history. It's all United States history, right? And one of the things that happens when we do that kind of siloing is that we, you know, forget and or erase some of those people out of the overarching narrative.
And Professor LaPierre, how do you think we should come to terms with the fact that 74 million people voted for this, knowing what he did the first time around? I mean, just in terms of whitewashing history, because people don't know about their history, or they choose not to know about their history. How do you think we should be thinking about that?
Well, I think it's really interesting. So I guess I should say, on the one hand, you know, I have a lot of students. I would say the majority of the students in my classes, one, they're taking a Native American history class from a Native American scholar, so they do know what they're getting into. But the students who take those classes, they want to learn this history. Mm-hmm. They want to understand what happened here in the United States. I don't think I've had a student who doesn't come through my classrooms who is not interested in knowing that. And they recognize that even within their own families, that people in their own family don't want to know that history, right? Or they want to know a different, or they want to kind of celebrate a different history. And so I think that I would just say one of the things that I'm seeing in my own classroom on a regular basis is students who want to know this history because they feel like they have been lied to. When they went through K through 12. So having said that, I think that it's something that I agree that there are a lot of folks who did vote for this administration, but I also think some of them were not 100% sure what was going to occur, or they thought something else was going to happen, in terms of what they were, what interests they were interested in voting for this administration. And I think that history, I'll just say this, United States history was probably not top on the list there. But having just, I'll agree with a couple of things that both you have already said and that Chanina has said is, you know, we do have to grapple with this idea that now that these executive orders have been signed, the truth and sanity executive order, for example. Now that some of these have been signed, people are definitely agreeing with it, jumping on board, and wanting to have a different narrative around U.S. history.
One more question about your students. How do you see your students change, or how does their thinking change after they take your class and learn about the true history of the United States?
Well, I'd say a couple of different things, and I'm sure Chanina's had a similar experience. One is a lot of students feel like they just didn't learn any of this, right, when they were K through 12. And so on the one hand, they feel like they haven't been told the truth, and they're beginning to learn some of this information that they want to know. And it is something that they feel like once they do know some of the stories that have that are part of our national story. For example, you mentioned earlier removal and the history of Andrew Jackson. I teach in the state of Illinois. The state of Illinois, until very recently, is a state that all of the tribes were removed, right? Because of the Removal Act of 1830. All of the tribes were removed, but they still all exist. Hmm. They just don't live in the state of Illinois anymore. And so the students in Illinois are really want to know that history. They really want to know, who are these people that used to live here? And now that I know they still exist, where are they? And, you know, how can I learn more about them? So I think they're very hungry for understanding this larger story, and they're definitely very interested in knowing how this all connects together.
Is this history in any museums in Illinois or in Chicago? Are there any wayside exhibits telling people about this history? I'm guessing a lot of people don't know that about Illinois.
Well, it's beginning to be told. I'll just say this. Historians write about these things, and there's been several sort of history books. But sometimes, you know, history is also very siloed in the sense that sometimes historians only talk to other historians, right? Mm. And historians read each other's work. And then we share it in the classroom. In terms of it being part of, public history, as it's called, in museums or where the public is going to see it, I would argue in places like Illinois, it's kind of far and few between. Hmm. Yeah.
What has your experience been, Professor at Lemay Wiemau? Because you have taught at the University of Washington, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State University.
Well, one privilege of my teaching career was that for most of my career, I taught rather large enrollment or called general education classes. You know, introduction to Native America sort of thing. And those ranged anywhere from 180 to 375 students per term. So I saw a lot of students over the years, many of whom were not interested in the topic, but it fit a gen ed requirement and was at 10 in the morning, which suited their schedule. I say it was a privilege because it was really challenging. How do you connect with people? And I always went on the theory that human beings learn by connecting new information to old information, you know, knowledge they already had in their mind. And we organized the classes that way to try to build on what we figured they knew coming to us from public high schools, private high schools about U.S. history and build on that to show the really vibrant history of Native nations and how we've been around at every moment in U.S. history and before. and played some pretty key roles. I would say it was a pretty interesting process over the years. There was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of what Roz referred to a minute ago of people feeling like not only had they missed out on something, but that information had been kept from them. Hmm. And that often prompted even anger, really. I saw that among both Native and non-Native students. How is it I got this far into college and never heard any of this before? I tried very hard to present classroom information as grounded in scholarship and research, because I knew many students came in with an attitude that, oh, this is just, in today's terminology, this is just going to be woke. This is just going to be kind of made up. And I think that was the biggest obstacle over the years, was overcoming that prejudice or that misapprehension about what and why, what we were teaching and why we were teaching it. But I think in the long run, what I learned is if you can build on what people know in a way that does not criticize them or seem to put them down for what they don't know, how is it that you got this far and don't know this? That's a killer right there. Right. People were pretty receptive to learning something new.
And that's one of the reasons why they're going after these universities and colleges.
Yes.
Because they know that there's so many young people who are just hungry to learn this history.
And it's not just colleges and universities. I mean, there's, I believe, an all-out assault on public education.
Right.
In this country, and that's really disturbing. That's where the erasure can have really devastating consequences.
Mm. Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about what happens when a country erases its history. So let's hear from John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. Hello, everyone listening. Erasure of history is a form of fascism. If you kill someone and say you didn't do it and then erase the history, you get away. That's not moral. It's fraud by omission. It's a form of fraud. I'm a lawyer and a historian, and that is fraud, and it's a sign of fascism. And what was done to the indigenous peoples of the Americas is an ultimate crime, rape, pillage, theft of land. And to say it didn't happen is an admission of guilt. And to erase it is worse. And my question is to the panel, what do you think? Do you agree? We're in the midst of a fascist takeover of the United States.
Well, thank you so much for the question. Professor LaPierre, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I would just say, I think we're in very, I feel like everybody says this, we're in some very interesting times right now. One of the things, I'm going to go a little bit off topic here. One of the things that we've seen, obviously, very recently is also a cut in a lot of science funding, universities have a lot of science programming, right? Science research, et cetera. And they often, I keep using the word silo, sorry. They often silo themselves off, and they don't sometimes quote unquote, like participate in the political, kind of political conversations that are often happening like in the humanities, et cetera. And I've been really surprised at a lot of institutions now where even in the sciences that professors, grad students are really speaking out about the role of science in America as an academic kind of stronghold here. And I'm just seeing sort of more scientists sort of standing up and saying we need to resist what is happening right now, and we need to stand up to what is happening right now, which is great because I feel like folks in, for example, the humanities have been the ones that have been taking the lead in a lot of these kinds of conversations around how this kind of, you know, change in the narrative, right? Not just sort of erasure of history, but erasure of a lot of different academic disciplines as a part of no longer seen as a strength, right, of the United States, but seen as something that we should not hold up anymore by through funding.
Right. And we've done so many shows about this. I mean, they're just absolutely gutting so many important government agencies, people years of experience who've dedicated their lives to public service are leaving. I mean, they're quitting or they're being pushed out. And some of these people say, I don't know if we're going to be able to rebuild this. So it's devastating. Professor Lume Wiema, before we go to break, what would you like to add?
Well, to respond to John's question about fascism, I mean, I think there's certainly signs and practices going on that we've seen in the past associated with autocratic and fascist regimes. The thing is, some of these things aren't new in the U.S., and they've perked along maybe under the radar a little bit, when I don't think folks would have raised the specter of fascism, but this erasure is nothing new. I actually had a couple grad students a few years ago survey U.S. history textbooks in high schools in a number of states, about 8 states in the central and western United States, and pretty much mention of Native peoples and nations disappeared after about 1880. With the exception of Navajo code talkers and Jim Thorpe. You know, so I find it deeply ironic, I guess is the word, that one of the websites that was taken down, Department of Defense, in this anti-DEI, supposedly anti-DEI initiative, was all mentions of Navajo code talkers. Well, as well as other, I mean, there are other Native code talkers, people who use Native language in both World War I and World War II. And it's like, that's so odd. I mean, that wasn't the U.S. military trying to diversify. That was using a skill that was useful at the moment. And, you know, it's been really valorized in recent decades for a variety of reasons. And you know, with honor to those folks who served in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, for that website to go down, one of the few things it seems that warranted admission into U.S. history textbooks. It just goes to show how, I don't know, is fear at the root of this? If we acknowledge Native nations and peoples that somehow threaten the identity of the U.S. as a nation, I guess it must.
Well, don't you think that the issue there is, well, what are they going to want if we acknowledge this? Are they going to want their land back? Do you think that's part of it?
I don't think most Americans take that question seriously. It's possible they ought to, but I don't think they take it seriously. It's just beyond the realm of possibility.
Do you think it's because of this idea that people have about the United States? I mean, you even have, I remember President Obama often talked about, what is the phrase on the hill?
The city on the hill.
Thank you. The city on the hill. Thank you. It's this whole idea, you know, you can, you know, become something so big in this country. It's the only country in the world that allows you to tap into your true potential, you know, the greatest country on earth. Do you think it's because of the story that has been told? Is that another reason why people don't want to really face up to the history of this country?
Well, I think if you believe in manifest destiny, if you believe in kind of a divine mandate for the establishment of the U.S. as a republic, which I think a number of people believe in those narratives, that the U.S. was founded as a Christian nation. You know, those are powerful narratives,
right.
And they're uplifting narratives for folks who identify with that. So I think it is difficult. I think it is difficult to give up the really uplifting, positive power of those narratives and how they make people feel about themselves and their nation.
Mm-hmm.
To acknowledge, you know, the less uplifting parts of the U.S., both historically and contemporaneously, in its treatment of various peoples and nations, both indigenous and otherwise. So that's really a tough one. And I have no silver bullet answer for how you address that, but I think that if a nation can face up to the less positive aspects of its reality, it's a stronger foundation going forward. But, you know, how exactly to accomplish that, I wish I knew.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and Professor LaPierre, I'd love to hear your thoughts when we come back. Today, we are talking about this political moment and Trump's second term as he quickly moves to whitewash U.S. history. He's moving faster this time than he did last time. Just a couple examples. He said he would no longer recognize Indigenous Peoples Day and would instead, quote, bring Columbus Day back from the ashes. He brought a portrait of Andrew Jackson back to the Oval Office, temporarily deleted federal websites featuring information about the Navajo Code Talkers during World War II, and cut $1.5 million in grants to Indian boarding school research projects. If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on these issues? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Again, Trump is so brazen about all of this, but it's about more than him. Is it possible for a country built on stolen Indian land to move forward without coming to terms with its past? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions for our guests, you can also email your call at kalw.org. Chenina Lemewaima is Muskogee and Creek Nation. She's a retired professor of Indigenous Studies who served on the faculty at the University of Washington, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State University. Her scholarship on the federal off-reservation boarding school system is rooted in the experiences of her father, Curtis Thorpe Carr, a survivor of the Chilaco Indian Agricultural School in Oklahoma, where he was enrolled from 1927 to 1935. Professor Lemewaima has written several books, including They Called It Prairie Light, The Story of Chilaco Indian School. Rosalind LaPierre is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana and Métis. She's an award-winning Indigenous writer, environmental historian, ethnobotanist, and professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Professor LaPierre works within Indigenous communities to revitalize traditional ecological knowledge and to strengthen public policy for Indigenous languages. She's the author of Invisible Reality, Storytellers, Storytakers, and the Supernatural World of the Blackfeet and City Indian, Native American Activism in Chicago, 1893 to 1934. She's also written two Blackfeet language lexicons. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will continue our shows about mental health. First, we will talk about what it will take to save the California Warm Line. It offers 24/7 peer-led support for anxiety, depression, substance use, and more. And they are possibly going to lose their funding. And the operations might end on July 1st of this year. So we'll talk about what is happening with that. That is state funding. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to talk about the Trump administration threatening to defund a suicide lifeline for LGBTQ plus youth beginning in October. The Trevor Project does incredible work around this. So we're going to talk about what is at stake here and what it will take to save such a critical lifeline for LGBTQ youth. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email your call at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Native American scholars, we're talking about this political moment. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Chinina Lomewaima is Muskoki and Creek Nation. She's a retired professor of Indigenous Studies who served on the faculty at the University of Washington, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State University. Rosalyn LaPierre is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana and Métis. She's professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And both of our guests have written books. They've done such incredible work on so many issues. You can learn more about them at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Professor LaPierre, continuing what we were talking about before the break, why do you think it is so hard for this country to really face up to its history? I mean, to think that historians talking about democracy hardly mention Native history, why is this the case?
Well, it is a really difficult history to learn and to process, for sure. I mean, if you start from just, you know, the very basics of, as has been said, you know, the United States was created on primarily stolen land from Indigenous peoples. The economies of what made the United States a major power in the world grew out of enslaved peoples. Just those two things alone, enslavement and Indigenous land theft, that's not a pretty picture, right? And so learning kind of that history, but then also just learning kind of the details of that, the nuances of that, I think is difficult, especially when we like to create a different kind of narrative about ourselves. Some of us would argue, including me, I mean, we have a tendency to create a false narrative of ourselves in the United States about what our past was, what our present is, and even what our future is. And you had mentioned earlier, you know, the city on a hill. We use a lot of that kind of imagery that is part, again, of this narrative that we've created about ourselves that we tend to celebrate, right? We're going to have a celebration, as we know, next year, right? For 1776, it's going to be the 250th anniversary. And I think it's going to be very interesting, the story that we are going to tell about ourselves, because it is going to be a new narrative about how we think of who we are based on what we've already been talking about today, kind of an erasure of our past histories.
Wow, yes, to think that the 250th anniversary birthday of this country will take place next year, with Trump in office, a guy who proudly decides to rehang a portrait of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office, who signed the Indian Removal Act and is responsible for, you know, what people know as the Trail of Tears. And that's just one thing. So what do you think these acts do to further whitewash history? I mean, as you say, a lot of people are speaking out. A lot of people are also afraid to lose their jobs if they speak out. So given how far he's going, again, he's moving faster and going much further this time around, Professor Lomewaima, how does this affect people's perception of the United States, people who might want to learn about history? But then now you've got Andrew Jackson coming back to the White House, Trump saying that He's not going to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day, cutting grants for Indian boarding school research projects. I mean, the fact that, and we'll talk about this in a minute, but the fact that it took this long just to have these investigations, to have these truth-telling sessions, says a lot about this country. But Trump is just, you know, once again, taking it to another level.
Well, I think there seems to be a pretty effective strategy there of moving quickly. I think that's an intentional strategy to shake things up and shake people up and just keep moving, present a moving target more or less. I think the defunding of the Native Boarding School Initiative is certainly it's economically insignificant amount of money in the federal budget. So, but it means something important. And I think it's an indicator of this continued erasure, blocking off information, eradicating or making sources inaccessible. I personally am a little worried that at some point the administration is going to figure out that the National Archives are a national treasure for doing scholarship to craft a more accurate historical narrative. I have a great fear that they're going to be targeted next or very quickly. In any case, I have to say that one of the things that disturbs me the most in the recent executive orders, the aftermath of the executive order about birthright citizenship, the Department of Justice filed a brief in January of this year arguing for the executive order, the right of the president to issue an executive order denying birthright citizenship. And in their argument, they cherry pick federal Indian law and policy. And when I say that, they pick out particular instances where Native nations and Native peoples were not recognized as U.S. citizens. That took a long time in this country. And they go so far to say is that the United States connection with the children of illegal aliens and temporary visitors is weaker. It's a weaker connection than its connection with Indian tribes. And then they go on to say, if the latter link is insufficient for birthright citizenship. So in other words, the connection that the United States has had with Native nations over centuries now of taking lands, treating people as legal wards under federal guardianship, denying them citizenship, denying them rights to raise their own children, so on and so forth, that's a weak connection. Huh. And it's insufficient for birthright citizenship. And that's the basis of their argument. Hmm. At some level, it's ludicrous as a legal argument, but it speaks volumes as an ideological statement. And so I think the ideology is pretty frightening, actually, of who is and who isn't deserving, for one aspect of U.S. citizenship, but more to the point, who has the rights to deny that, and who has the right to create this new narrative, and who has the right to withhold information or make resources inaccessible or to strip grant funding from educational institutions. Mm-hmm. That's an egregious exercise of executive powers that I don't think the founders, in their very careful delineation of the separation of powers in the Constitution and the checks and balances, I really don't think they had this in mind.
Wow. Professor LaPierre, what concerns you the most so far?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I think the thing that concerns me the most is just, you know, asking the question, you know, does truth matter? Mm. Right? Does history matter? As you mentioned for another piece, you know, what's at stake here? What's at stake here when we don't want to know and understand what happened in the past. And I would say there are some people right now in the US who say that it doesn't matter, right? Because there is this effort right now to create this new narrative. And like I said, we'll see it really next year come to the forefront when we are celebrating the Declaration of Independence. I think we're going to see a lot of multiple new narratives about our history, who we are as a people, what we value, what our moral center is. I think that that's all going to become part of a larger conversation that we're going to have next year. And those things are being developed right now, right? So I think that my overarching concern is, you know, does the truth matter to us as a country? And as the caller had said earlier in the program, you know, asking about, you know, whether or not we are heading towards fascism, I have seen in other people's commentary comparing what is occurring right now in the United States to the Cultural Revolution, right, that happened in China, that because of changing what is important to us and what we value. So I'll end there.
Well, it's also incredible because they're moving so fast. Someone who called but couldn't stay on the line said, do we know if Native students at Cal or any other universities are losing their funding? And I just did a quick search. I mean, this is head spinning. ProPublica, she's on a scholarship at a tribal college in Wisconsin. The Trump administration suspended the USDA grant that funded it. New York Times, tribes and students sued Trump administration over firings at Native schools. More than one quarter of the staff members at the only two federally run colleges for Native students were cut in February. High Country News, Trump's funding freeze of indigenous food programs might violate treaty law. It just goes on. Here's another one from K12dive.com. CTE grants for Native American and Hawaiian students retracted by the Education Department. Nearly $21 million in grant competitions do not, quote, align with the objectives established by the Trump administration. I can go on. I mean, Professor LaPierre, they are moving so fast.
And absolutely.
They're so meticulous. I mean, food programs for the Blackfeet Nation.
No, absolutely. They're moving very fast. Wow. And as other people have said, it's happening so fast, it's hard to keep track. It's hard to keep up. And that is an intentional, you know, methodology. That's an intentional method to just overwhelm us, right? It's like a tsunami. It's like a tsunami of changes. And it is impacting, absolutely, it's impacting Native students. It's impacting Native scholars. It's impacting Native programs across the United States. One of the things that I know that national, both tribes have been pushing back. Tribes have also been suing the United States government for certain aspects of this. Also, you know, national NGOs, such as like the National Indian Education Association, pushed back. And they recently received a letter a couple weeks ago executive, from the administration, that said that Native American education does not fall under kind of the rubric or the umbrella of DEI or CRT, because Indigenous nations are seen as having political status and a government-to-government relationship with the United States. So one of the things we have seen is when tribes and NGOs push back, that they're beginning to make headway in terms of kind of winning the conversation. But that doesn't mean that those losses where students are losing funding or programs are losing funding, that is still happening. And that is very detrimental to the people and the staff and the faculty that are involved with that. But I'm hoping that as tribes continue to push back and as these national Native American NGOs push back, and remind the U.S. government that tribes are different, right? That tribes have a political status, that tribes have a government-to-government relationship, that tribal funding for I mean, that funding for tribal programs is not discretionary spending, but it is mandated often in law, especially relationships based on trust and treaty obligations. And also that the United States government has to make any changes in consultation with tribes. They can't just do it unilaterally. So I'm hoping that my hope is that with people sort of standing up and resisting and pushing back, that we're going to continue to see these wins that are occurring.
Well, we have a number of callers who wanted to weigh in here, but we're out of time. We'll continue this conversation. Adele in Oakland wanted to say that I read the Indigenous Peoples' History of the United States and cannot understand why this history is being suppressed. We also have an email from Marsha who says Brendan Lindsay's book, Murder State, California's Native American Genocide, is very, very difficult to read because of the horrible truth of our history. One thing Lindsay says over and over is how the democratic process was used to organize and fund this horrific genocide. We actually had him on the show many times. You can find those shows at KALW.org, and it is such an important book to read. But as you say, I had to put this book down so many times because it's very personal. For me, but also just so incredibly brutal. But this is the history that we need to learn, especially now. We're definitely going to continue this conversation. Rosalind LaPierre is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana and Métis. She's an award-winning Indigenous writer and professor of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Chanina Lomewamai is retired professor of Indigenous Studies who served on the faculty at the University of Washington, the University of Arizona, and Arizona State University. Rosalind and Chanina, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.